That's at 11 o'clock, but now it's 7.30 and time to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom. It's presented by Penny Gore.
Welcome to the Royal Albert Hall and to an evening that includes some dramatic musical skirmishing. We have a colourful prom tonight given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra under the baton of the Russian-born conductor Semyon Bychkov. Combat will commence later between the two pianos of the sisters Katia and Maria Labeck. They're giving the first UK performance of a piece written specially for them by the Swiss composer Richard Dubunion, his Battlefield Concerto. And then there's a little more wrangling in the second half of the concert when Richard Strauss squares up to his critics in the piece that seems to present a tongue-in-cheek self-portrait, Ein Heldenleben, a hero's life. First, though, a work that the critics never got to pass an opinion on during its composer's lifetime because he didn't finish it. No one knows why Schubert's Eighth Symphony was abandoned partway through, although it wasn't unusual for him. He left behind sketches for at least another three symphonies, which never progressed much beyond the drawing board stage. Well, this one did get a bit further. It was begun in the late autumn of 1822, and Schubert managed to finish the first and second movements, plus a fragment of a scherzo, before coming to a halt. Or maybe at one point he did intend to finish the whole piece, but he obviously gave up on that idea. A year later, he presented the two completed movements to a friend, with instructions to pass them on as a gift to a music society which had elected him as an honorary member. So that, I guess, was the end of any further work on the score. Well, luckily for future generations of music lovers, the friend didn't follow Schubert's strict instructions and pass on the manuscript. It stayed firmly in the family until 1865, and at that point it was finally discovered by an inquisitive conductor, who then arranged the first performance in Vienna more than 40 years after Schubert's death. Since then, of course, the rest is history, as they say, and the unfinished symphony has gone on to become a firm fixture in the orchestral repertoire. And the BBC Symphony Orchestra, who are about to play it in a couple of moments, just putting the finishing touches to their tuning, gathered on the lowest level of the stage, although ranged around them at the back some intriguing instrumentation, percussion mainly, which is going to come into play a bit later with that Battlefield Concerto. And members of the audience very curious as they've been filtering in here, walking down the steps to their seats and peering at the huge array of drums, gongs, tam-tams, cymbals, and goodness knows what else, which we'll be hearing later. For now, though, Schubert, and applause now for the guest leader of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, Sergei Livitin. And making his way on stage now, Semyon Bychkov, who will begin tonight's prom by conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra in Schubert's Symphony No. 8. There it ends, Schubert's Symphony No. 8, The Unfinished. Performed tonight at the BBC Proms by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Semyon Bychkov. And it was announced yesterday that he's had a special position with the orchestra created for him, the Günter Wandt Conducting Chair. It's a way of cementing the relationship between orchestra and conductor, begun here at the Proms. And the chair's named in honour of the BBC Symphony Orchestra's former principal guest conductor, Günter Wandt. Well, thank goodness for Anselm Hüttenbrenner, Schubert's disobedient friend, who instead of passing on the manuscript of that symphony as he'd been asked to, squirreled it away for the next 40 years or so. And it's a mark of its popularity here at the Proms that it appeared in the very first season in 1895. And it's featured very regularly since, notching up over 100 performances to date. And Semyon Bychkov back on stage, picking out a couple of the players. Principal oboe Richard Simpson, principal clarinet Richard Hosford, principal flute, and the whole of the woodwind section now. Michael Cox, the principal flute, the horns too. And their colleagues in the orchestra applauding. And in fact, everybody's getting a turn as Semyon Bychkov spins round to bow deeply to the audience here at the Royal Albert Hall. Well, I mentioned at the start of the concert the impressive array of percussion that's arranged around the back of the stage, and it's going to come into its own in a few minutes' time after some fairly major stage moves get underway, making ready for the second work in tonight's prom. It's the first UK performance of the Battlefield Concerto by the Swiss-born Richard Dubunion. He wrote the piece specially for the French duo and prom's favourites, Katia and Marielle Labeck. Now, just as the title implies, the concerto involves a musical war between two pianos, each with its own section of orchestra. But its inspiration came from a visual source, a triptych of paintings by the Florentine master Paolo Uccello, The Battle of San Romano. Now, one of the three paintings is a prize exhibit at the National Gallery here in London. You can also see it now on the BBC Proms website. Just click on tonight's concert. And I paid it an early morning visit.
I'm with Caroline Campbell, who is the curator of Italian works at the National Gallery. We're standing in front of Uccello's amazing painting, The Battle of San Romano, which, first of all, Caroline, is massive.
Yes, it's a very, very large painting. It shows you how, when you see things in reproduction, you have no idea of their scale. But this is one of three paintings made together for a palace in Florence in the 1430s. And these rooms were quite small, so it must have had a very amazing appearance when it was first produced. The other paintings are in the Uffizi in Florence and in the Louvre in Paris.
Tell me a bit about Uccello. How did he come to paint this triptych of works?
Well, Uccello is a very interesting painter. He was very interested in perspective and mathematical theories. He's alleged to have said to his wife one night, "Oh, what a beautiful thing is this perspective." And this is a painting of a battle, or rather, I should say, a skirmish. It was a rather undistinguished episode in a war between Florence, Milan, and Siena in 1432. But Uccello dignifies it largely by his use of perspective and putting all these broken lances on the ground to give a sense of a vanishing point and more lances at the left hand corner to make it into something much more impressive than it really was.
And we've got this incredibly foreshortened figure lying at the front, a slain knight of some description.
What's interesting is that top part of the picture where you see a couple of knights climbing up what seems to be a hill, a lot of that was covered by repaint in the 19th century, and it was discovered when it was cleaned at the National Gallery in the 1950s or 60s.
It's painted in an incredibly bold way. There's great blocks of colour. In some ways, it's quite stylized, and the eye is drawn to this enormous, I mean, literally a knight on a white charger who's sort of almost in the middle of the picture. Do we know who that represents?
Yes, this knight who's in a white charger and wearing a beautiful hat made of sort of red and gold fabric is someone called Niccolò da Tolentino, and he was the captain of the Florentine forces, and he led the charge into this battle, which we know took place on the 1st of June 1432 in San Romano, which is a very tiny place near Pisa. This charge that he made apparently was the start of the battle, and it was really impressive because the Florentines had very few men compared to their opponents who were from Siena, and apparently this was decisive in turning the battle towards Florence's favour.
So what we can see is obviously an amazingly violent, almost hand-to-hand, lance-to-lance battle with these broken bits of lance all over the floor. And it's pretty brutal, isn't it?
It is pretty brutal, but it's also pretty ordered. It seems as if there's a progression and a pattern to this battle, as if it's divinely ordained, as it were, which is what people like to think of history being in the 15th century. But actually, warfare at this time was brutal, as you say. Very nasty things happened. Horrific injuries were engendered. I mean, just sending a lot of horses and men at each other at lances is not a pretty sight.
And we've got these people up on the hill above who are also seem to be part of the battle. They've got pickaxes. Are we to assume they're digging graves, perhaps, for the dead?
They might be, and some of them also have crossbows about to shoot people. Arrows, of course, and archery was one of the lethal weapons of the 15th century battlefield.
So the battle obviously was going on many fronts at the same time, and the people we can see in the foreground are sort of, if you like, the important parts of the battle, the people on the back of the sort of rank and file who are just continuing the skirmishing.
Absolutely, and we know that this battle went on for an entire day. They started at 8 in the morning and they only ended at dusk.
And although there's a lot of action in this painting and obviously an enormous amount of hand-to-hand combat going on, it's quite clean and clinical in the sense that there's no blood, there's no gore, there's no nasty stuff going on.
It looks as if it's all planned. And the chap who's leading the charge, Niccolò Tolentino, is not even wearing a sort of battle helm. He's going in wearing the most extraordinary hat. And I'm sure he wouldn't have done that in the actual battle. And the man, young man behind him, has even taken his off. So we're really seeing a very unreal depiction of warfare here.
It's interesting, there's a lot of different textures. You mentioned the hat, and it looks almost as though it's sort of cut out of fabric. It's very much in contrast to the dark background behind it. And the chainmail is so fantastically picked out, in contrast to the quite large sort of areas of flat painting on the horses. I've read that Uccello was very interested in mosaics at one point, and it's almost as like a mosaic technique.
It is almost like that technique, but also he was very interested in sculpture. And when you look at these horses, they have great barrel shapes. They're almost like looking something in a three-dimensional sense. And I think he's trying to convey that in the two-dimensional materiality of paint. This picture would also have had much brighter colours. At the moment, you can see all the soldiers. They're wearing a sort of grey armour, but it would have been silver. This is just a natural process. Silver tarnishes with age and with exposure to air, so that was just going to be lost. It wouldn't have lasted more than 100 years after it was made, but it would have been spectacular with the silver and gold and the red and the bits of orange you can see poking out as well in the foliage.
Yes, orange bushes to the left and the right, which is sort of extraordinary effect. It's almost like little globes of light. And what medium did Uccello use to paint it?
Well, Uccello used a very traditional medium. He used egg tempera, painted probably on poplar. Most Italian paintings of this date are painted on wood, and they generally used poplar because it was the wood to hand, and it was quite cheap and easily accessible.
And what happened to the picture after it was initially painted, or the three pictures? They were displayed together, presumably, originally?
Yes, the three pictures were displayed together. We know that they were commissioned for a family called the Bartolini-Salimbeni, and probably for the marriage of Leonardo Bartolini-Salimbeni in 1438. And this is really quite exciting new art history. Until about 10, 15 years ago, it was assumed they'd been made for the Medici family. They were found in one of the rooms of Lorenzo de' Medici's palace in 1492 after he died. And Lorenzo, of course, is one of the great names of the Renaissance, one of the most enlightened patrons that lived. But actually, they weren't made for him, and he stole them, it seems, in about 1484. He was one of the executors of Leonardo Bartolini Salimbeni's will, and there was a dispute between his children as to who owned the goods in the palace. And Lorenzo was meant to arbitrate this. He must have seen the pictures at this point, and he thought he wanted them, and he took them. And after he died, his children went to court, but unfortunately, they didn't get them back. They stayed in the Medici family.
Dr. Caroline Campbell, the National Gallery's curator of Italian works, was talking to me about Paolo Uccello's The Battle of San Romano. The triptych of paintings which inspired the work we're about to hear, the Battlefield Concerto by Richard Dubugnon. And if you'd like to hear that feature again, incidentally, you can click through from the Proms website. Well, while we were listening to that, the entire orchestra filed off stage and a battalion of orchestra staff and stage movers zoomed in to stack chairs, move plinths and music stands, reposition the conductor's podium, and of course wheel in the two pianos, which are now nestled together at the front of the platform, though not necessarily nestled in friendship, because the concerto we'll hear will be pitting the two soloists, Katia and Maria Labeck, against each other. And then the pianos having made their appearance, all the chairs moved back, music stands were replaced, and finally the orchestral players, as you can hear, returned to the stage. Well, I mentioned the percussion before, that impressive array of instruments now has a bevy of players positioned and ready. And I might also mention some other notable pieces of orchestration. We've got a bass guitar in the orchestra tonight. We'll also be hearing two off-stage trumpets, which, although not on the platform itself, will be visible to the audience. And there was some discussion during the rehearsal as to just where they should stand, and a few positions were tried before they ended up positioned on either side of the organ. Richard Dubugnon was saying that it varies very much according to the hall that the piece is being played in. As I said, this is its first UK performance, but he said he rather likes the fact that they're visible and on stage, at the back of the stage, I should say. The next time it's played, he said, they might be somewhere completely different. I think the main thing that he wants to achieve with this piece is its pictorial aspect. He describes it as being theatrical at times. The work opens, he says, with a fanfare, with drums and trumpets on those balconies, both armies calling for battle. The offstage trumpets play their own bell-like tolls, which will remain identification marks for the respective armies. After repeating those tolls, the two pianos introduce their respective themes, the main themes of the concerto, which won't be shared until the very end when the armies reconcile. A double cadenza for the soloists follows, representing their parley or negotiations,
which develops into a burlesque parade. And there are some interesting effects evoking corteges in the fields, coming closer, crossing, and going away. The character of the music becomes more charged with aggression, then leads into the most developed part of the concerto, the battle itself, consisting of furious episodes in four different major sections. And here are the protagonists. Katia and Marielle Labeck making their way on stage now, with Semyon Bychkov following on. And they're going to give the first UK performance of the Battlefield Concerto by Richard Dubunion.
Thank you.
The UK premiere of Richard Dubignon's Battlefield Concerto, performed by the duo for whom it was written, Katia and Marielle Labeck, who are now applauding the composer, Richard Dubignon, as he makes his way on stage here. He was born in Lausanne, and he has dual nationality, in fact, Swiss and French. He studied in Montpellier and chose to follow parallel careers as a composer and a double bass player. And actually, he had a spell of studying here in London, too. He graduated from the Royal Academy of Music. And Semyon Bychkov lining up with the two soloists and Richard Dubignon. The composer said he couldn't resist the chance to write this piece for Katia and Marielle Labeck. He was interested, he said, in reflecting their different personalities as well as exploring whole new ways of writing for two pianos and orchestra. He noticed that normally the two pianos tend to play together, and he thought he'd have a go at seeing what would happen if they didn't do that and instead were represented as contrasting elements. It's just the latest in a line of new works by distinguished contemporary composers written for Katia and Marielle Labeck. They're great advocates and supporters of contemporary music. They were recently the subject of a documentary by the Spanish film director Pedro Almodóvar. And they've been working recently on a new project in New York, the Minimalist Dream House, which involves artists and musicians from both classical and rock music fields. And they're back on stage now. Two very vivid personalities reflected in their concert outfits. Deep purple for Marielle and a neon green jacket for Katia. And applause now for the members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra. The two offstage but visible trumpets were Gareth Bimson and playing bass trumpet Duncan Wilson. And joining the BBC Symphony Orchestra, unusually, a bass guitarist, James Woodrow. Semyon Bychkov bringing up the rear as soloists and composer make their way off stage. It's a bit of a family setup tonight. Semyon Bychkov is married to Marielle Labeck, and the two sisters coming back on stage now. Thank you. A bluesy, jazzy encore from Katia and Marielle Labeck. And it's nice to see that Semyon Bychkov and Richard Dubignon didn't go off stage but perched themselves at the back by the tents and just grooved away to that. Jet Song from Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story, which Katia and Marielle Labeck have recently been recording. Rather nicely continuing the theme of battle, of course, between the Sharks and the Jets in Bernstein's show. And back they come. Their career really began with the recording of George Gershwin. And it's been onwards and upwards ever since. A best-selling record, that one. And he's still a favourite composer of theirs, although they've also pursued separate careers, Katia in particular. Records on their own label and pursues projects of her own. But of course, they get together, as they did tonight so very memorably here at the BBC Proms. Well, we've reached the interval in our prom tonight. In 25 minutes or so, we're going to hear the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Semyon Bychkov, in just one work, Richard Strauss's tone poem, Ein Heldenleben, A Hero's Life. Meanwhile, it's time to join Rana Mitter and his guests for tonight's Proms Plus literary event, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, across the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Good evening. I'm delighted to be joined by one of the rising stars of the musical firmament, the conductor Edward Gardner. Appointed as music director of the English National Opera before he was 40, he's been associated with a range of innovative productions, and he's also something of a constant gardener at this year's proms. He'll be back conducting Britain's Peter Grimes on the 24th of August. But tonight, he'll be talking about what happens when he lays the baton down and what he reads in his spare time. I mean, Edward, you have a pretty constant conducting schedule. How do you choose what to read in that precious spare time that you actually have?
I'm terrible about taking scores to bed and reading them up close to bedtime. So when I'm working, I tend to be reading either around the pieces I'm doing or reading the scores themselves. So when I get a chance, when I get a holiday, I read as much as I possibly can. I'll take tens of books on holiday with me and just get through them feverishly.
And when you do that, are you making a sort of rational choice? I have a certain number of pieces of fiction, certain number of non-fiction, or is it just what you can find on the shelf to shove in the suitcase?
Well, I go for a lot of, late 20th century, early 21st century fiction. Something historical. Historical things about London and about England I'm fascinated by. And it's mostly because I gave up history when I was 13. And I have a terrible knowledge of our history and the history of this city. And I find it really intoxicating to read about it now. Also historical novels, which is very dangerous if you don't have any history because you think everything you're reading is true. And the odd, Busman's Holiday book for sure, but very limited. It's more about newish fiction, actually, when I read.
Well, you've given an indication of some of the pleasures that are coming up, and it's also a great pleasure that we have the actor John Rowe with us tonight, who's going to read some extracts from some of the books that you've chosen. And we're going to hear the first one, which comes from last year's Booker Prize winner, The Sense of an Ending by Julian Barnes. John.
My bookshelves were more successful with Veronica than my record collection. In those days, paperbacks came in their traditional liveries, orange penguins for fiction, blue pelicans for non-fiction. To have more blue than orange on your shelf was proof of seriousness. And overall, I had enough of the right titles. Richard Hoggart, Stephen Runciman, Hautzinger, Isink, Empson, plus Bishop John Robinson's Honest to God next to my Larry cartoon books. Veronica paid me the compliment of assuming I'd read them all and didn't suspect that the most worn titles had been bought second-hand. Her own shelves held a lot of poetry in volume and pamphlet form. Eliot, Auden, McNeice, D.V. Smith, Tom Gunn, Ted Hughes. There were Left Book Club editions of Orwell and Koestler, some calf-bound 19th-century novels, a couple of childhood Arthur Rackhams, and her comfort book, I Capture the Castle. I didn't for a moment doubt that she had read them all, or that they were the right books to own. Further, they seemed to be an organic continuation of her mind and personality, whereas mine struck me as functionally separate, straining to describe a character I hoped to grow into. This disparity threw me into a slight panic, and as I looked along her poetry shelf, I fell back on a line from my old teacher, Phil Dixon. Of course, everyone's wondering what Ted Hughes will do when he runs out of animals. Are they? Well, so I've been told, I said feebly. In Dixon's mouth, the line had seemed witty and sophisticated. In mine, merely facetious.
Well, John Rowe there conjuring up the spirit of the protagonist Tony Webster from The Sense of an Ending by Julian Barnes. And I had to say, I was cringing in recognition during that particular passage, Edward, because, well, in my case, I think I seem to remember moving a copy of The Vivid Orange Spine of a copy of I, Claudius onto my shelf. I'm not sure quite who that was supposed to impress. I mean, was that one of the reasons the passage appealed to you, that it basically was a familiar experience that you had?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, yeah, it certainly, I blushed and sweated slightly as I read it with recognising the pretensions of a young university student. It very much so. It's so beautifully written in that sardonic way. It's a kind of essay in the passing of time as much as anything else and repercussions of consequences of your life. I marvelled at it as much as identified with it and the way your perceptions of your past and what you've done and what you've experienced change with your emotional state. I mean, there's this wonderful theme that runs through the book of him, the protagonist, going to see the Severn Boar. And his memory of it changes acutely, actually, both emotionally and in terms of who was there with him through this book. And it's magically put together.
You also said that nonfiction is, and history is, one of your loves, and we should in a moment hear an extract from one of your nonfiction choices, which is Nigel Jones's book, The Tower, which he describes as an epic history of the Tower of London. And we're going to start with a passage which describes a new arrival at the zoo established in the Tower by King Henry III back in the 13th century. John.
In 1252, the creatures at the Tower were joined by another exotic animal, a polar bear sent to Henry by King Haakon IV of Norway arrived, along with a Norwegian keeper. The first ever seen in England, the polar bear attracted enormous public curiosity. When the 2 pence a day allowance provided by the sheriffs of London for its upkeep proved insufficient to meet the beast's appetite, the bear was allowed to fish for free food in the river running past its tower enclosure. With his usual attention to detail, Henry spelt it out. Greetings. We command you that for the keeper of our white bear, lately arrived from Norway, ye cause to be had one muzzle and one iron chain to hold the bear without the water, and one long strong cord to hold the same bear fishing or washing himself in the River Thames. 3 years later, in 1255, when Londoners had got used to the strange sight of the bear swiping salmon out of the Thames, an even more wondrous beast lumbered into view. Befitting its size and status, the entry of this new addition to the Tower menagerie was slow and stately, attracting enormous crowds en route, like the progress of a superstar, which it was. The first elephant to appear in these islands plodded up the pilgrim's way from Canterbury to London, led by its keeper, Henricus de Flor. Yet another gift to Henry from a fellow European monarch, Louis IX of France, the elephant made a spectacular entrance to the Tower via a large riverboat. Such was the jumbo's celebrity that the aged contemporary chronicler, the monk Matthew Paris, was lured from his abbey in St. Albans to the Tower to see the new arrival. Drawing the elephant in a memorable picture, as well as in words, the beast is about 10 years old, possessing a rough hide rather than fur, has small eyes at the top of his head, and eats and drinks with a trunk.
Many thanks, John. I mean, that's an extraordinary thought, a polar bear fishing on the banks of the Thames. I think wasn't even thought of as part of the Cultural Olympiad. This was clearly going one stage beyond that. Did you know anything about this wonderful detail of a private zoo at the Tower of London before reading this book?
I did know something about it, but the book it goes into incredible detail about it. And I love, one of the things I like about this book is the pageant of it, that you really get this, it's a very brutal book in many ways and focuses on lots of, warring skirmishes amongst other things, and changes of monarchy.
I mean, is it that wider historical pageant and, you know, this sort of mixture of pageantry and violence that fascinates you in terms of the wider story?
I feel a big vacuum in my knowledge about history, and it's something which I'm more aware of the more I do. And, you know, my work is based in history. It's based in, you know, the context of great musical works of art over the last 400-500 years. And I'm mildly ashamed that, well, I put it stronger than that, I'm pretty ashamed that I don't have a stronger knowledge of the story around that. I went recently to Australia and I took Simon Sharma's History of Britain as an audio book. And listen to that every night with jet lag, actually. And I saw Timothy West, who's narrating it, actually came to a performance at ENO soon after I got back, and I told him that he helped put me to sleep every night, which wasn't necessarily such a big compliment for a great actor. But it's just something I'd really want to develop in myself.
When you're actually preparing an operatic production, do you find that there's a need to actually read up on the history of the story or the circumstances in which the production came together? And I'm thinking you're conducting Peter Grimes later at the Proms, and of course George Crabbe's poem, The Borough, very much at the background of that, adapted, of course, in the 20th century for Grimes. How important is that background reading for you on that sort of production?
Yes, it's very important, actually, and Billy Budd recently as well, that we've done at ENO. I do, more and more I do, actually. And I've been fortunate recently to do a lot of music where the composers were at least around their recordings. In Britain's case, he was conducting, you know, many of the recordings, and the flavour of that time is so important to capture, and it's hard to do in the modern world, I think. I'm thinking of pieces like Rosenkavalier, which I've conducted this year. I think you need to know the flavour of what was going on, and it was immensely helpful for me to listen to Eric Kleiber's recordings from the 50s in Vienna to get a sense of that. I mean, it's a perfume, isn't it, that you can't just pluck out of the air in today's world.
Well, let's stick with the Tower of London for a couple of minutes more, because in many people's minds, it is regarded as a place of torture and of terror. And of course, as you've suggested, that is in Nigel Jones's book. But it was also something of a refuge for at least some people. And the second extract you've chosen suggests that rather strongly. John.
King Henry VI vanished for more than a year, leaving behind only a few pathetic belongings, including his crown and a spoon. He was sheltered by loyal northern gentry, shuttling between their homes and sometimes, appropriately for such a pious man, disguised as a monk seeking sanctuary at religious houses. In July 1465, the fugitive king was hiding at Waddington Hall near Clitheroe in Lancashire, the home of the Tempest family, under the care of his former carver and chamberlain, Sir Richard Tunstall. But one member of the family, John Tempest, did not share his relative's Lancastrian loyalty. Informed by a treacherous monk of the mystery guest at the hall, Tempest organized a posse. When they arrived, a furious struggle ensued. Tunstall held the pursuers off, breaking Tempest's arm in the process, while Henry, accompanied only by two chaplains and a single squire, made off into nearby Clither Wood. Later that afternoon, Henry and his companions were caught, crossing the River Ribble by stepping stones, and arrested. Humiliatingly, Henry, wearing a straw hat in the summer heat, was mounted on a poor thin nag. His feet were bound under the stirrups by leather thongs, and lashed to his saddle with rope, he was brought to London. He was received at Islington by the Earl of Warwick and led through the city's streets towards the Tower, a placard scrawled with insults around his neck. It was a tragic and frightening return to his capital for the mentally frail, fallen monarch. As the forlorn little procession rode through Cheapside, Cornhill, and Newgate, ribald crowds of Londoners followed their progress, yelling abuse and hurling refuse and stones at the helpless captive. The saintly Henry heard his wife called a whore, and worse, before the Tower's gates mercifully closed behind him, muffling the hostile jeers. It was to be his home for the last decade of his sad life.
I mean, Edward, when I read that passage and also heard John reading it so beautifully there, I thought, on the one hand, you know, clearly what an awful moment for the king, but also what an operatic moment.
Maybe that's why I liked it so much. I mean, certainly, the story of Henry VI itself is fascinating because he was such a spiritual, artistic, and gentle man. I mean, strange, I'm sure, but that idea of him, you know, in public view, so close, in such close proximity to the braying public, being taken back into London is extraordinary. And we can't identify with that at all nowadays. It's really an amazing image of both the jeopardy of the time, and also an incredibly sort of close relationship between the public and the monarch.
Is it that sense of the kind of the turbulence, the flavour of politics lived almost on the streets during much of the time that this book covers that appeals, do you think? I mean, in some sense, it is rather different from a more democratic and, for the most part, perhaps, thankfully, more tranquil era that most of us have lived through.
Not sure. I'm not sure how to answer that. I mean, I love living in London. I wasn't born here, but I really feel it's my city. And I love living in a historical part of London. And anything that I live about a mile away from the Tower of London itself. And anything that just makes my vision of the city or my vision of the history of the city more keen, I really love. I find it very, you know, I find it fascinating.
And obviously we're right in the middle of the Olympics at the moment, and, you know, London is, you know, the focus of the world, at least for a couple of weeks. Do you feel that, along with this very strong sense of community which has been created, not least due to great sporting success, we could do with more of a sense of that historical trajectory that underpins the story that we've come to now?
It's hard, that, isn't it? And Olympics is about celebrating the present time and the future, one, you know, you hope. I mean, the opening ceremony, I suppose, had a flavour of some of the history of the country, but I'm not sure it's possible to do that. But hopefully, what you hope is that everything that's created by such an extraordinary sporting unifying event like the Olympics can be carried forward. I think it's much more forward-looking.
And I think that brings us to your final reading, because this is, you know, as you described, I think, earlier, a busman's holiday. It's a book on a subject that couldn't really be closer to home, and that is, of course, conducting. And this is the book Music as Alchemy by Tom Service. Now, it's a series of biographical sketches. It takes basically six conductors and their orchestras and says something about how they work on a particular concert at a particular time. And in a moment, we're going to hear a passage about Tom Service's experience of hearing one conductor, Ivan Fischer, conducting Mahler. But before we start, could you tell me why this particular passage jumped out at you when you were reading this book?
The passage, the chapter about Ivan Fischer and the Budapest Festival Orchestra, it starts off with this wonderful description of how they start rehearsals. And the conductor, and it's so utopian, and it could never, there are so few places in the world where it could exist. The orchestra tune up together under the direction of the conductor, and then they'll play Bach chorales together before they even, you know, get to the main meat of their programs, just to, you know, experiment and get a sense of sound and you know, the sense of ranges of sound and tuning. And it's kind of, yeah, it's wonderful and completely unique, I'd say.
From the opening bar, the music is energized by a collective will from the orchestra to make all the characters, colors, and contrasts that Fischer had developed in the week of rehearsals as vivid as possible. From the vice-like grip of the implacable repeated notes at the start of the first movement, the symphony creates an energy that is impossible to resist. It's a performance of gigantic structural momentum, a vindication of Mahler's self-conscious classical pretensions in this piece. More than any other of his symphonies, this piece takes the forms of the conventional 19th century symphony and stretches them to breaking point. But it's also a thrilling existential drama in which symphonic form is transmuted into psychological experience. The immediacy of the relationship between Fischer and his players releases something I have never heard in this music before. For those 90 minutes in the concert hall, there is no distance between us, the composer, the performers, and the piece. The Sixth Symphony is a journey we go on together, which Fischer and the players unflinchingly take to ecstatic, tragic extremes. By the end of the finale, the performance had created a trance that I find difficult to escape. The terrifying reality of the music makes the world of applause, of people, of social interaction after the concert seem a hollow illusion. It takes hours before the trance or the truth of Mahler's music recedes.
Thank you, John. Edward, Tom Service was clearly pretty much overwhelmed by the experience of hearing Fischer and the Budapest Band playing this Mahler Sixth. When you're on the podium, are you able to actually ever give yourself over to being absorbed by the performance in that way? Or when you're the man at the front of the orchestra, is there always a part of you that simply can't allow yourself to dive in quite that way?
I think you can be completely absorbed by a performance you're in, but it'll always be in a different way from an audience. And I mean, the performances where I felt most most integrated with somehow are the ones where you don't feel like you're working to create anything. It's just sort of happening with you and around you. Opera's very interesting like that because there are so many different facets, the singers, the children's choir, the offstage musicians, the pit, that you almost don't know when the great performances of a run are going to be. And you know, I love it for that. I love that a performance is created and vanishes in the ether. But I don't think you ever have the same experience as someone in the audience. Another conductor said something very funny to me when this other conductor thinks he's done the most world-beating performances, he's told by people in the audience it's one of the worst, performances of something you've ever given. And then, conversely, when you feel like you've had a terrible evening in the pit or on the concert hall, because you felt slightly out of control, people tell you it had risen to great glories because of it. But so it's hard to say. Your experience is so different from that of an audience.
But when you are in the audience listening to someone else conducting something, do you find something of that kind of total absorption that Tom Service was talking about in the way?
Oh, sure. In great performances, for sure. Yeah, yeah. You're united with an audience in that. Yeah, I think an audience in a collective way feels that actually, which is it's a really wonderful thing to be in an auditorium as part of that mass of people experiencing something on that level.
In Music as Alchemy, Tom Service, he analyzes these conductors in a very rigorous way, but broadly speaking, he seems to divide them into two categories: conductors who really go minute by minute, page by page, over the score with the orchestra over and over again, and the guys, I'm not going to call them chancers, but people who live a little bit more on the edge, people who are really sort of saying, let's busk it and then see what happens on the day. Do you see yourself in either of those categories?
Well, I suppose that's how people divide conductors generally, isn't it? I mean, it's way too broad to say you're in one or other the category. I love the fact that he doesn't actually try and unify what these people are in the book, actually. I think he really presents a series of personalities working with a series of orchestral personalities, which I find is much more truthful. I wouldn't like to... It's up to other people to categorise me, I think, probably.
That's fair enough. And but within the book, there are particular conductors, and they're pretty much big-name conductors, whose technique he analyses. I mean, even Fischer is the extract that you chose there. Is Fischer someone that you know, that you've worked with?
I've trained a chorus for him in Salzburg many years ago, but he's someone I've admired, and I've admired that, as Tom would say, that alchemy, or that, you know, that connection between a great orchestra and a great conductor is something which really fascinates me, and that connection between any orchestra and any conductor is really fascinating, and he has something very special with that orchestra.
If you had one fantasy conductor, as it were, that you could spend time with and look into his technique, who would that be?
I think most conductors give you the same answer, which is Carlos Kleiber. I was fortunate enough that one of my great friends didn't send me a clip of him conducting Rosenkavalier on a Pitt camera until after I'd finished conducting Rosenkavalier, because it's effortless and brilliant and varied. And I think you'd want another career after watching too much of his stuff, because it's peerless and so expressive, but so the intention of it is so clear.
Well, with those thoughts, we are, I'm afraid, drawing to a close for this event, but it's been a great pleasure to have you here. So many thanks to Edward Gardner, and many thanks also to our reader, John Rowe. Thank you both very much indeed.
Rana Mitter presented this evening's Proms Plus Literary event, and the producer was Zahid Worley. Well, this is Penny Gore welcoming you back to the Royal Albert Hall and this BBC prom given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra under Semyon Bychkov. We're live on BBC Radio 3 and online, where you can listen in high definition sound. And you can follow us on Twitter too, at BBC Proms is the place to be. Now, it was announced just yesterday that Semyon Bychkov has had a new post with the BBC Symphony Orchestra created for him, the Günter Wandt Conducting Chair, a mark of the warm relationship he's forged with the players. And next, he conducts them in a real orchestral titan by a composer with whom he has a great affinity. It's Richard Strauss's tone poem Ein Heldenleben, commonly translated as A Hero's Life. Although tonight's conductor, Semyon Bychkov, makes a subtle distinction.
Ein Heldenleben, to be translated correctly, would not mean hero's life. It would mean heroic life. And that is quite interesting, because it stops being about an individual, whether it is Strauss or it is anyone else, a specific hero. Once you think that it is about heroic life, well, every life is heroic. Every life that is worthwhile is going to be heroic, because there are sacrifices that are going to be made, losses that will be incurred, certain goals that will need to be attained, and they can only be done through utmost dedication. So the piece become a lot more meaningful, and not a description of war or love. It is actually a life cycle. And that a man, as young as he was when he composed it in his early 30s, was capable of expressing something so true to life that he was also able to anticipate in the final coda what he and every one of us will feel throughout different stages of one's life, including the final stage. That is really as great a genius as one can be.
Semyon Bychkov. Well, at almost 50 minutes long, this work is as heroic in scale as it is in subject matter, and written for large orchestral forces. Strauss wrote the piece in the late 1890s, when he was at the peak of his early professional career. He'd become a well-known conductor, especially distinguished for his interpretations of Wagner, while his own composing career was progressing nicely too, thanks to a string of impressive tone poems. Within a few years, he'd embark on his long run of highly successful operas. But all this apparent good fortune wasn't quite as seamless as it might sound. Strauss's first opera, the Wagner-inspired Guntram, hadn't been a great hit. In fact, the critics had given it a real pasting. And Strauss had a long memory when it came to professional slights. The whole painful experience of the opera was just one of the ingredients that he blended to produce Ein Heldenleben. although he did keep his sense of humour. The protagonist, let's say with at least elements of Strauss himself, is just too noble and upstanding to be true, bravely battling with those critics whose mean-spirited carping emerges as a gruff chorus of woodwind, two tubas and trombones. But our hero wins the day in his battle with the bad guys. Cue a mischievous quote from the horn theme from Don Juan. Finally, he withdraws from the hustle and bustle of the world with his faithful companion by his side. And that's a thinly disguised portrait of Strauss's own wife, the soprano Paulina de Anna, who was famed for her volatile personality. Strauss once described her as very complex, very feminine, a little perverse, at every minute different from how she had been the moment before. And all her lightning changes of mood are captured by a coquettish solo violin. And the BBC Symphony Orchestra just settled down, awaiting the arrival of Semyon Bychkov, who makes his way on stage now to conduct this BBC Proms performance of Ein Heldenleben by Richard Strauss.
Thank you.
Well, is it a hero's life, or as Semyon Bychkov prefers, a heroic life? Maybe something of both in Richard Strauss's great tone poem, I'm Heldenleben, performed here at the Royal Albert Hall by the BBC Symphony Orchestra under Semyon Bychkov, newly appointed holder of the orchestra's Günter Wandt conducting chair. And that great cheer you just heard was for the guest leader, Sergei Levitin, in beautifully capricious mode. And a few special mentions for other players. Amin Merchant, the principal second violin, has just given his last concert with the BBC Symphony Orchestra. He's off to lead the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra. And going around the sections, Caroline Harrison, the principal viola, principal cello, Susan Monks, and the woodwind who made such a wonderful contribution, principal flute, Michael Cox, principal oboe, Richard Simpson, principal cor anglais, Alison Teal, and principal clarinet, Richard Hosford, really bringing out the beauty of that piece. And Semyon Bychkov has spoken often about how important Strauss's music is to him, and you could really tell that from his rehearsal and the performance. He feels it so deeply and delves into the music. He's eager to find every little nuance and really stressing the beauty of Strauss's long sweeping lines. A few more players to pick out: the principal bassoon, Julie Price, and principal horn, Martin Owen. The guest principal trumpet and first E-flat trumpet was Martin Griebel, and the first B-flat trumpet, Gareth Bimson. Semyon Bychkov making his way back on stage now. Great cheers from audience and orchestra. And Sergei Levitin shaking the conductor's hand and taking his own solo bow. Well, there's not much rest on the cards for the players. They're back in action on Sunday in Schoenberg's mighty cantata Gurrelieder with conductor Jukka-Pekka Saraste. I'll be back here too then, but with this applause and these cheers still ringing round the Royal Albert Hall, I'll return you for now to James Jolly for the rest of the evening on BBC Radio 3.
Thanks very much, Penny. That was Penny Gore at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Monday the 20th of August at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. We return to the Royal Albert Hall for our next prom tomorrow night at 6:30 for a concert given by the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by Jon Sturgårds, in music by Sibelius, Delius and Grieg. And now, a few minutes later than scheduled, Adam Nicholson concludes his exploration of the ideas of Arcadia in Western culture, asking why every version of idyllic life seems to contain its opposite, death and darkness. Yesterday's feature took him to Virgil and Horace's Italy. This evening, we begin closer at home, in Renaissance Wiltshire, dark Arcadias.
The Arcadian ideas inherited from classical Rome came in a double stream, one from Virgil, who is really interested in making a world that is perfect as a whole, and the other from Horace, who is looking for a perfect spot in a troubled world. But both those streams had really rather faded in the Middle Ages, and only in the 16th century did they start to enjoy a new Renaissance. And that's what I'm going to explore in this programme. The way in which they flowered in Elizabethan and Jacobean England, in the great landscape parks and gardens of the 18th century, and then on into the more difficult conditions of Victorian and modern Britain, where all that gentlemanly smoothness of Arcadia came to seem inadequate or wrong in various ways. And then how this long story delivers us to a double conclusion, the Virgilian desire to conserve the world as a whole in its best possible state, and the very Horatian search, which we're all engaged in, for a micro-Arcadia, for little spots of beauty, where the Arcadian idea has become more private than it's ever been. But we begin here on the banks of the River Nadder in Wiltshire, at one of the great Arcadian palaces of 17th century England, Wilton House, the home of the Pembrokes. The extraordinary thing about this painting is that the girl in the middle of it, the young woman, she's only 12, and she's about to get married to that beautiful young man. And she is bringing with her into this glorious gilded world a dowry which is worth 2,000 years of a Wiltshire shepherd's salary. £25,000, and a Wiltshire shepherd would have earned £12.10 in the year. And I think in some ways that is the heart of this Arcadia, that it is about massive privilege, enormous wealth, absolutely dominating power here in London, nationally, even internationally, this huge sort of quasi-royal family indulging an idea that their place here in this gilded, enriched, massively demonstrative, sort of fat, fruity room is in fact a kind of act of nature. And there's a very odd, unmodern elision of things in that, that we think somehow nature is easy, accessible to all, a kind of general, almost contentless place. But the Renaissance idea, inherited, of course, from all those Roman ideas, is that it too has a hierarchy. Hierarchy is beautiful in it, and that the people at the top of the hierarchy, these satin gilded beasts, are the most beautiful. This was the house and headquarters of the whole enterprise of the Earls of Pembroke, who were almost certainly the richest family in early 17th century England. They owned tens of thousands of acres of Wiltshire, huge acreages of central London, intimately involved with the court, with James I, Charles I, and great patrons, patrons of Shakespeare, of Herbert, of Johnson, of Donne, enormously and centrally involved in the whole cultural enterprise of England. And this room, designed by Inigo Jones in the 1630s, is a double cube in that kind of very sort of exact neoclassical way, but enormously embellished with carved fruits, carved vegetables, carved caryatids, a vast painted cove, almost certainly painted by the people who painted the scenery for the masks that were put on in Whitehall. And so you've got a complete capsule of 17th century loveliness here. And right at the end, dominating the room, as it's meant to, is the largest painting that Van Dyck ever painted, 17 feet wide, 10 feet high, filled with the family who owned this place. They're painted slightly larger than life size, so that they loom over the room, almost like a royal family at the end of it, on a slightly raised dais, but with an intriguing mix of inside and outside in the way the picture is set. You can't quite tell where it is. It isn't exactly in a palace. It isn't exactly on the steps of a palace. It might even be on a stage. To the right, there is a giant coat of arms implying their inherited grandeur. To the left, an Italianate, receding, sunlit landscape, the Arcadian world, which extends from that edge of the picture through the windows and into the valley of the Nadder outside. The man who sits in the centre of this painting is Philip, the fourth Earl of Pembroke, who was a courtier to James I and then Charles I. But it was his grandfather, William Herbert, an absolute brute of a man, a bruising condottieri, really, of mid-Tudor England, who first came to Wilton in the 1540s, was given it by Henry VIII because his sister-in-law married the king, which is sort of winning the lottery in Tudor England. And then around the house, as one did, he laid out a park. And a park is, of course, the vehicle for any number of Arcadian ideas. It is the place where ease and happiness and elegance and beauty can all fuse and intersect. It is the landscape of Arcadian dominance. And to make his park, he kicked out some of the villagers who'd been living just on the far side of the river over there. And in the late 1540s, they, impoverished by the denial of their ancestral lands, decided to reclaim part of the park, and they reinvaded it, as in fact many parks were reinvaded in England in the late 1540s. And Herbert, instead of accommodating or negotiating with the invaders, went to Wales, where he had other vast estates, gathered an army of his tenants from there, marched them back to Wilton, invaded his own park, hunted and killed his own tenants in the park, leaving it then a satisfactorily pure and natural space in which his soul could expand. And that place in which he had killed his own tenants, was the place in which his son's wife's brother, that is Philip Sidney, would later come and write the Arcadia, which he dedicated to his sister, the Countess of Pembroke. And so you have as tight a fusion as you like between violence and Arcadianism. Arcadianism is inconceivable without the damage done to those ordinary people 20 or 30 years before. It has its own guilt built into it. The idea of Sidney writing about the beauty of the Arcadian life in this dominated, controlled, and crucially excluding space is deeply ironic, because the vision that Sidney was trying to recapture of the shepherd at ease with his flocks was actually available to him outside the park boundary. There they really were, Wiltshire shepherds in their long white woolen hooded cloths, looking exactly like you'd imagine them in some painting by Lorraine or Poussin. But of course, living in conditions of grindingly desperate poverty, the price of a shepherd's crook, as paid for a young countess to appear in a Whitehall mask, would have been pretty well what a shepherd was paid in the course of an entire year's work on the Wiltshire Downs. When Sidney was here visiting his sister in the 1580s, he was noticed riding across these hills by the local farmers, and one of them was the grandfather of the great 17th century gossip, John Aubrey, on whose farm I am now, just near Broadchalk. And Aubrey's grandfather remembered Sidney, as he told Aubrey, hunting in our pleasant plains and taking his table book, that's a reusable notebook, out of his pocket and writing down his notions as they came into his head. "My sheep are thoughts," Sidney wrote in that notebook, as if poetry and reality fused here. And you could say that is a definition of Arcadia. It's a place where there is no distinction between the real world and the dream world. There were hills which garnished their proud heights with stately trees, humble valleys whose base estate seemed comforted with the refreshing of silver rivers, meadows enamelled with all sorts of eye-pleasing flowers, thickets which, being lined with most pleasant shade, were witnessed so too by the cheerful disposition of many well-tuned birds, each pasture stored with sheep, feeding with sober security, while the pretty lambs with bleating oratory craved the dam's comfort. Here a shepherd's boy piping, as though he should never be old. There a young shepherdess knitting and withal singing, and it seemed that her voice comforted her hands to work, and her hands kept time to her voice's music. As for the houses of the country, for many houses came under their eye, they were all scattered, no two being one by the other, and yet not so far off as that it barred mutual succour, a show, as it were, of an accompanable solitariness and of a civil wildness. Now that's Sidney's description of the downs that I'm sitting on now and which he rode over when staying with his sister at Wilton. A description really of a completely at-ease world, a world in which nothing is too busy, nothing too desolate, nothing too close, nothing too crammed, nothing too isolated, where every ingredient seems to enjoy the presence of the other. In other words, it is a well-arranged world, a civil wildness. It's not about, you know, romantic horror or shock or excitement. It's about comfort and being at ease. And of course, the unstated thing is that the person who feels most at ease is Sidney himself. It's a strangely unknown bit of England, this, which is odd to say that because it's right in the middle of the busy south of England. But here, sitting in one of these dry, grassy valleys, bottoms as they're called, in Wiltshire, with vetches and knapweed and hawkbit scattered all over the sides of them, like a kind of William Morris wallpaper. Cattle just grazing, some sheep over on the other side there. I mean, this looks extraordinarily like it must have looked to Sidney, almost unchanging. And there's something Arcadian in that too, that when these grandees come here and acquire this because they're in with Henry VIII and are making the right deals with the power structures, they find themselves possessors of a world which looks like, and perhaps in some ways has never changed. It looks as if this is the eternal state of affairs, one in which they have a natural place. And I think there is a deep comfort in that, that for all the stress and struggle and doing down of one's rivals that are necessary to get here, when you get here, it looks as if none of that has ever happened. Well, here we're just, I'm just on the banks of the Ebble, the little chalk stream, which is on John Aubrey's farm, just a few miles west of Wilton. And it's right in the middle of this really lush and juicy bit of river valley. And the whole structure of this part of the world is that you have these beautiful streams with lovely clear water that you can see the grayling and the trout in, all hiding in the shadows in the corners of the waterweed. And then above them, the chalk downs on both sides. And so the world is sort of strung between the wet and the dry, between the rich and the habitable, and the high and the sort of slightly austere. And this is the kind of necessary part of the balanced world. And one of the great things about the vision of Arcadia that Sidney found here, and which Aubrey and his whole family loved him for, was that it wasn't just a sort of little window, it wasn't a little display park of the Arcadian. It was genuinely a whole world. And it's a whole world not only physically like that, but socially too, so that the way in which people lived with each other here was deeply bound together. I've just caught the weed on the far side there. No, but the way in which they lived here was very carefully and consciously designed to be a sort of balanced world. And so the relationship between landlord and tenant, between the people living in the villages and the people living in places like Wilton, wasn't just a cash relationship,
There were mutual obligations on each side, and people in the 16th century wrote theories of land ownership in which there were chapters called love, which you wouldn't find many estate agents, courses having that nowadays. But love was meant to be the essence of how these places worked. And it's not only love between people, but it's love between different animal and vegetable and geographical parts of the valleys that they lived in. It's not at all surprising that this is where Arcadia came to seem like a possibility, that it's away from harassment. It's like a life spent fishing. One of the beautiful things about Wilton and Sidney's vision of Arcadia there is that it wasn't just a private little garden dream of the perfect world. It was genuinely and really social. It was absolutely involved with the well-being of people who were living there in farms and villages, of arrangements between the grandees and the poor, which weren't exploitative, which did give dignity to the peasants as they really were. I mean, of course there was fierce differences in wealth and the things that they could control, the physical things they could command. Of course there was. But against that background of hierarchy, there was an idea that the Arcadian needed to consider the well-being of those who didn't have access to material things. And something of that falls away in the course of the 17th century. And so by the time you come to the great British Augustan age at the beginning of the 18th century, the vision of Arcadia has become much more aestheticized, has dropped much of its social dimension, and has become really a desire to make a beautiful picture, a beautiful image, something which can gratify you, the owner of it, without much concern for what's going on outside its boundaries. So if the Wilton and Sidney view had in a way been Virgilian, then what takes over from that in the 18th century is a Horatian love of the perfect place, and in effect let the world go hang, recognise its pains. But it's not what I'm going to be interested in, sitting back and drinking my glass of Pinot Grigio. This is Rousham in Oxfordshire, William Kent's pocket handkerchief masterpiece of a very, very early landscape garden. And it is like a little fragment of the dream of Italy transferred to the English Midlands. Little valleys, little woods, little dropping lawns, stone goddesses and gladiators glimpsed around the corner of yew trees and laurel bushes. A kind of shrinking of the Sabine Hills to something that can't be more than 5 or 6 acres, but so sleekly designed that somehow you feel that there is largeness around you. You're only ever in small corners of it with the hint of a Roman arch or the columns of a little temple, often very, very miniaturized. But you get the sense that the world might continue beyond these boundaries in as perfect a condition as it is in here. And right in the middle of it is the thing which makes it one of my favourite places in the whole world, called the Rill. A little spring, a tiny little spring, comes out of the hillside just below one of these temples and then runs down in the middle of a slightly valleyed gravel path between glossy laurel bushes on either side and with dark shade of yews hanging over it. And it runs down in this very narrow stone trench, no more than a foot wide, and the water in it about an inch deep. just curling slightly as it comes down this shallow hillside, just a kind of very, very easy turning. Not regular, nothing stiff, nothing sort of polite about it, just water totally at ease in the world into which it's emerged. And it is like a kind of metaphor of perfection. Its silence is so incredible that this water running here at my foot, you can hear it if I put my fingers in it. But even if I put my ear within half an inch of it, there is no noise at all. And I'm sure that's part of it, that there's nothing broken, you know, nothing interrupting its feeling that the world is all right. It is a very, very well-dressed bit of wildness. It's bien soigné nature, and entrancing for that. But I can't help but have another thought about it, that, well, there's something that Walter Benjamin, the great Jewish cultural critic in Nazi Germany, said that, I think this is a paraphrase, but it's what he meant, there is no act of civilization which is not also an act of barbarism. That somehow the distillation of perfection here must come at a cost. And the historical truth is that beyond these walls, beyond the walls that are invisible from inside Rousham, but are very, very visible when you drive around the outside of it, beyond them the world was not like this, that 18th century England saw, you know, very fierce exploitation of the rural working classes, that those social relations which had been at least in some way in play at Wilton were really suspended, the whole process of enclosure, of actually imposing boundaries, is part of this same world here, which wants to say they don't exist. And it's true, they don't exist for the rich, but my God, they did for the poor. And oddly enough, it's a 20th century poet who voices this terrible doubt about the beauty of this kind of place, better than any other. Yeats's poem called Ancestral Houses, which was published in The Tower in 1928. Surely among a rich man's flowering lawns, amid the rustle of his planted hills, life overflows without ambitious pains, and rains down life until the basin spills, and mounts more dizzy high the more it rains, as though to choose whatever shape it wills, and never stoop to a mechanical or servile shape at others' beck and call. And that is right, that's the dream of Rousham, that somehow this is a place dizzy with its own sense of the beautiful. But then he talks about the glory of escutcheoned doors, the pacing to and fro on polished floors amid great chambers and long galleries lined with famous portraits of our ancestors, that somehow behind this dream of loveliness is an act of violence. Some violent, bitter man, some powerful man called architect and artist in, that they, bitter and violent men, might rear in stone the sweetness that all longed for night and day, the gentleness none there had ever known. Oh, what if gardens where the peacock strays with delicate feet upon old terraces? Oh, what if levelled lawns and gravelled ways, where slippered contemplation finds his ease, and childhood a delight for every sense, but take our greatness with our violence? That is why Arcadia is dark. The 18th century inevitably gives way to a hunger at the end for something harder and rougher and truer. In the middle of the 18th century, when Edmund Burke wrote his essay about the sublime, the sublime was an understanding that some kind of recognition of what was valuable happened in the gaps between things. He had a famous and marvellous title to one of his chapters, which was "The Vegetable Is Not Sublime," because the vegetable grows slowly. And what was sublime was, for example, the gap, especially at night, Burke says, the gap between the bongs of a ringing bell. So it's not the bong, it's not bong, bong, but the hole between the bongs, in which you somehow feel in touch with a truth that is richer, deeper, and less social than the sort of world that Rousham represents. So that gap between the bongs is also provided by wild, rough, difficult landscape, a place where you can't think that if you started growing your vegetables you would be happy, where you can't even think that lying down might be the thing to do, where actually the falling of a waterfall down